Thank you, Dr. Norman. Now, she didn't finish the story, which is I forced her to read my book, and she sent me her dissertation. We have a verb in Syracuse called dissertating, and that's what happens when you ask a doctoral student what their topic is. And after 30 minutes, you know they're not ready to defend. You got to do it in five, but you did very well. And thank you, once again, coming from Syracuse, New York, thank you for bringing the snow out to make me feel welcome. That was delightful as well. I'm going to tell you something that you already know, which is that it's very impressive to have a statewide library event where you get the Secretary of State, where you get the Gates Foundation, where you get all of these in a room. It's hearing this, hearing the support for libraries in this state is impressive and amazing. However, as a speaker, I've had to throw out all my jokes about politicians and funders, so it's going to be a considerably shorter speech. Let me just get this out of the way. Do we have any lawyers in the crowd? All right, I can keep those in. Oh, no, there those go. All right. So thank you. What I'm here to talk about today is I want to talk about libraries, and I want to talk about librarians. Now, I realize we have civilians among you, so I will do my best not to descend into lots of three-letter acronyms as I do this, because really what's interesting to me is that we know that libraries are changing. The question is, what are they changing into? And we know that with this change, librarians must change as well. The question is, in what direction and what skills? But the other thing know is that the future of libraries, the future of librarians, will be defined by a community and not by the librarians themselves. It will be a conversation amongst all of us as what we need, what we want, what we can do, what we can't do. Where does that support come? So I want to talk about social compact, but before that, I always like to just make sure that, you know, I'm real upfront with folks. This is what I believe. And as I'm talking about these ideas, and as I'm working on these ideas, these undergird all of those. So I believe that the best days of libraries are ahead of us. That these discussions about obsolescence, these discussions about them being cliche, these discussions about being stuck in the Stone Ages and et cetera, that they are garbage. Right? The librarians in the crowd will realize that when you go to a conference and you get someone outside of the library community that wants to be provocative, they start by saying, and all books will go away and they'll all be e-books. And all the librarians sit there and, you know, it's like, well, they might not, but frankly, what does it matter? We're still working here. That libraries are uniquely positioned to lead in the knowledge age. That there is a very special opportunity afforded, particularly to public libraries, that are afforded to nearly zero sectors outside of it. If you think about the reach and span of librarians, if you think about the reach and span of libraries, what other sector can you point to that quite literally deals with newborns to people in palliative care? What other profession ranges everything from people looking for jobs to people running Fortune 500 companies? What other profession is invited into the halls of power, are invited into the games at home, that are working in our hospitals and in our law firms and in our schools? There is very few professions that provide such connective tissues to society left. We are uniquely positioned, and it's an opportunity that we cannot squander. However, we won't get there with a focus on artifacts and on consumers. Now, I realize that as I'm looking across these books, this may not be the message that you are expecting about being our guest and consumerism, but let me make this clear. You are not a user, right? Computer scientists and drug dealers have users. You are not a user, you are not a customer, you are not a consumer. You are a participant and in control of your world and able to shape it. When we talk about people of Delaware and citizens of Delaware, when we talk about the people and patrons who come into our building, they are not there simply to consume. They shape it. The idea that somehow, and I, once again, always good to kiss up to the people who invite you, I don't like the phrase servant leadership. I don't want to be a servant. I believe in the notion of collaboration. I believe that we are of the community, not simply for the community. I believe that when we look at the people and we look at what we're trying to do with citizens, when we're trying to do with employees, when we're trying to do with students, we're trying to say, don't simply sit back and take what you are given. Shape it. What we try and talk about is, do you want a job or do you want to change the world? Do you want to enact your passion? And maybe in the good times, that passion is your job. But sometimes that helps you support your passion. And the point is, the passion is the thing we need to care about. Yes, we need to get the resources. We need to worry about it. But we need to help people shape it. In Vermont, we did one of these in Vermont. I love this story. Vermont's like, everyone has their poster child story. This was the entrepreneur poster shop story they brought out. It turns out, in like north near Canada, Vermont, there was an older gentleman who loved snowmobiles. Go figure. I mean, loved them to the point of annoyance. He would buy them. He'd buy broken ones. He'd buy parts all his life. And what he ended up with was this massive barn full of dead snowmobiles. His grandson comes back from college, takes a camera, and creates a digital inventory of all the parts and pieces in the barn, throws it online with a credit card ordering form, with the grandfather's permission, not always true, and he created a worldwide snowmobile part distribution center that was selling regularly to Siberia because they ran out of parts. Right? Now, my point of this is he probably didn't collect the parts going, someday I'll be the eBay of snowmobiles. But this idea of how we enable people to find their true passion, to enact that, to make it happen, I think that's what we're here and that's what we're about. That's why I also, let me just get a few other terms that I don't like out. I'm just going to be cranky. So user, gone. Consumer, gone. There are consumers. Disney has consumers. Customers, don't like it. I like the word member. Now, this comes from Joan Fry Williams. Joan Fry Williams was part of a strategic planning process at a library, and they were trying to say, well, what do we call them? And she goes, radical idea. Hold on a minute. Went out and actually asked people in the library, what are you? And they came back overwhelmingly with, we're members. We got a card, right? We have a membership card. I pay taxes. I pay my dues. And that concept of membership in libraries is a radically different idea. It goes from us as stewards and keepers of stuff for them to us being a place with them. Another story to sort of tell you that difference, Eli Nyberger at Ann Arbor District Library in Michigan had a member come up to him and say, you know how I can go on your catalog and find if you got a book? Yeah. Because you know how I can find if you got a book, even if it's not in this building, but it's in another branch? Yeah. He goes, I got books at home. I'm perfectly willing to loan them. Can I put that in my catalog so when you find a book and it's at my house, I can just bring it in to lend it to you? Now, if you are for the community, if you are a servant of the community, if you are an instrument that's going to serve a customer, that is the craziest idea you've ever heard of. Right? No, no. This is our collection. This is our stuff. Right? But if you're of the community, if you're a membership organization, if you're all the library, it makes perfect sense. It's like, yeah, that makes great sense. Right? Another story. North Onondaga Public Library. Meg Bacchus, the greatest librarian ever, well, one of them, former student of mine, doing brilliant things. She found this gentleman who is a loves Civil War history. And so what she started doing as an adult program is she would bring him in, and he started talking about Civil War history. And suddenly people started showing up, and they're arguing about what regiment was here and all this stuff. This person makes his living as a warehouse worker at Michael's. But he lives to do this kind of information. And the library has given him a context, a forum, a passion. So what I'm talking about is artifacts of stuff. Libraries are not just big warehouses. We are not book museums with ivy and a coffee bar. Right? We're not dealing with consumers. What we are, what we need those libraries to be, are engines of community improvement. And that's going to happen through partnerships, through programs like this. Now, the other thing I should say is that throughout this process, and we're talking about broadband and stimulus, there's going to be a real interesting idea that we're going to devolve to this. Right? That at some point, someone in this room will use the term gigapop and not giggle. Right? That at some point, now, understand, my background is actually in this stuff. So we had a great phrase, which was more wars. Now, they're not wires, they're wars. It doesn't matter what part of the country you're from. They're still wars. Right? So if something ain't working, we need more wars. When we were hooking this up today, we were getting this interesting feedback pattern. What was the problem with the video cable today? A war, right? We needed more wars. You can solve the wars problem. Now they're glass, but that's just not the same. Right? When you hear broadband, when you think about the internet, when you hear speed internet access, I've heard people say, it's like having the Autobahn, the superhighway, coming and bringing data into your library. And I watch librarians go, hey! Because they have headlights on the front of those things streaming into your library, right? That's not what this is about. When I think about broadband and thinking about the internet and gigapops and all this other stuff, we tend to think of them like this. It's the fire hose. More stuff, more stuff. That's a consumer view. We can get more stuff to consume. Think about how ingrained this is in your world. If you have broadband in your home through the cable company or the phone company or something, you probably have learned the difference between downstream and upstream, or symmetric and asymmetric, meaning we give you 14 megabits per second, and we're allowing you to upload at like 2 bits per minute, right? Because all you want to do is get Netflix at home. God forbid you actually want to share a file. What? Right? So we need to stop thinking about broadband stimulating our ability to consume and start thinking about broadband as a megaphone to inflict the world with Delawareans. To take our voices, our passion, our ideas out to the world. And even better, we need to start thinking of broadband as the ability to build this, to build the piazza, to build the community square, to build the agora, to build the true university of the public. The true university of the public. A university is not a place where we go and have consumers that we call students and we take their tuition. We do that. It's supposed to be a place where we discuss and fight and drag out ideas. I'll pick on Dr. Norman again. I can call you Annie. I like Dr. Norman. By the way, get your great seats on airplanes, but it's because they think you can start someone's heart again. I just warn you that. Now I've totally lost this case. I had a master's student. She goes, I finally figured it out. I said, what? The trick with grad school. I said, what was it? She goes, well, when I was an undergrad, I'd go up to a professor, and I'd ask him a question. The professor would tell me the answer. And as a master's student, I would go up, and I would ask this professor a question, to which the professor would respond, great question. And as a doctoral student, I would go up to a professor, and I would ask, what about this? And the faculty member would respond, let's write a grant. That's the difference in the education system. What we look at with broadband, what we look at with video conferencing, is it goes two ways. That those students on the other end can talk back. That it's not simply a broadcast world. So when we talk about a new librarianship, and I say it's not about consumers, the reason is the true power of Delaware is in its ability to talk, in its ability to converse, in its ability to struggle with problems, in its ability to be creative. And these stimulus grants should stimulate more than simply infrastructure improvement or video conferencing hardware purchase. It should stimulate a revolution in how we think about things. That instead of talking about citizens as somehow they vote and leave, they're participants. That this is a way to stimulate not only jobs, but democracy. To stimulate participation and advocacy. To stimulate libraries to get out of their buildings and into their communities and bring their communities into the library. Because what's happening is the social compact around libraries, that compact is changing. Now, social compact is an idea that's been around for a long time. What it means is when you're an industry or an organization or a sector, you have to work with the community that's going to instill you with power. right? A constitution that says the people cede this power. Charters that say you're allowed to be a library district, that you're allowed to be, I'm sure there's a state library charter at some point. And the way it works is at some point when that power is given, it is done through a negotiation from friends groups and government and libraries and industry and taxpayers. They all come together and say, this is what a library is. Yay. The problem is that over time, those compacts change and shift and evolve. And these parties are not always part of that conversation. In fact, what's happening today, right now, in this room, is that we have seen an increasing divergence of the parties having a conversation on what is a library. We have a situation where in some cases the librarians have run far beyond their community. And their communities are going, wait, I don't know if I buy this broadband thing. We have communities that have run far beyond libraries going, where the hell are you? We have stopped a dialogue, and simply going to a board meeting once a month with agendas does not count as a community-wide conversation. We need to say, this is what a library is. Is a library a place of books? Is a library a place of gaming? Is a library a place of learning? Is a library even a place? Because without that ongoing conversation, without that active agreement, what we end up with is, that's over in that silo, that's over in that silo, that's over in that silo. So I think part of this, the great thing about having a Secretary of State and the Gates Foundation and partners together is this gives us, it's always great when you can bring people to the table with money, this is a great time to have that conversation. These graphs and these figures, which I love in lifelong learning, this is part of a new social compact. For those in the field, Melville Dewey, for all his wonderful anti-Semitic, you know, misogynistic nature, forged a new social compact, which was that the library was about efficiency and effectiveness. And I think there are many librarians that need to break out of that and go, wait, world's too sloppy for universal classification. World's crazy. We're not going to be able to buy a book on this, right? It's the old joke. You go up to the reference desk, you ask what time it is, the librarian hands you a book. Right? That's not it anymore. Likewise, when they come up and they ask you what time it is and there's this enormous 6-foot clock behind you, we probably shouldn't, but every so often we should go, hello? So we have a need for a discussion about a new social compact around libraries, because libraries are changing. Libraries are changing from quiet buildings with loud rooms to loud buildings with quiet rooms. That is a fundamental shift. I was taking the train down from Syracuse yesterday, and behind the club car is the business car, and behind the business car is the quiet room. Please do not use your cell phone in the quiet room. It should retain a library-like atmosphere. I felt like I should run back and start a book group. That's where the coffee is. Let's go. Someone had a new phrase, libraryistas. You know, we didn't. Anyway. That they've gone from places of knowledge access to places of knowledge creation. The idea that you go to the library to learn what everyone else knows is dying. You go to the library to teach everyone else what you know. The notion of kids going to libraries to do podcasts that they can now create their music and their voice and have it broadcast around the world. Where authors can come in to earn and learn, but they can also then become print-on-demand centers. They can do their own promotional materials. Local historians coming in to figure out what is their place in the world and how does their memory work. The idea that libraries are places not simply to come and learn about the rest of the world, but where the rest of the world can learn about us. When someone goes to your website, can they learn about your community? Or they get a picture of your building and access to catalog. Where's your stuff? When you have a speaker come, does that become part of your collection? When you have an event, does that become part of your collection? Think instead of collection management, we need to start thinking about connection management. when someone asks you a question, the best person to answer it is your neighbor three doors down. Do you have a system to get the question to them? Can you find that Civil War historian who's working as a warehouse worker and bring more joy and passion to their life? This is our collection. Our communities are our collections. How much more interesting and diverse and powerful is the idea that our community is our collection, that we maintain and we manage and we connect and we organize and we work together with? And we could weed, but that's a whole other discussion. Than the idea that we deal with stuff. Right? OCLC does study after study. When you think of library, what word do you think of? Book. But what's amazing about words is that they have so much meaning. It's like the tip of an iceberg. What do they mean by book? Do they mean learning and knowledge and literate? Or do they mean paper and dead trees? What is it? How do we understand? How do we take that idea further down? How do you, community partners, work with your library to say, this is what I need from you? Right? So in another state library, in another state that will go without mention, but Abraham Lincoln came from there, the state library is sitting there going, how do we connect to our legislators and lawmakers? Well, it used to be when you wanted to take the library to someone, you had to have like a diesel engine in front of it, right? Bookmobiles! Doesn't work so well in the state capitol. They try and stop you. Now, you need this. I grew up in Glendale, Ohio. Glendale, Ohio is this little patch of green trees on Google Maps. You know, development, green trees. Procter & Gamble, Procter didn't want to live in Cincinnati, so he built himself a train track to Glendale, Ohio. All right, Silver Spoon, insert now. Okay. Glendale wanted a library. It didn't matter that within a mile and a half distance on either direction were already existing public libraries. They wanted their own because communities have libraries. All right, so what did they do? They knocked on doors and said, we need a library. Give us your, ready for it, books. And so what did they do? Everyone walked back and said, well, I haven't read this Danielle Steele in 2 years. Have that one. And, you know, I haven't read this. Oh, you're never going to guess what the secret is that one. And they had a building, and they filled it full of books. And the first week, oh, my God, it was swarmed, and people came. And the second week, like four people came for a book group. And by the fifth week, it was like one kid who couldn't afford books who came in, which was great. But what they found out, and I know this is going to startle you all, people don't want to read books they've already read all the time. What if instead they took one of these and they knocked on the door and said, you know what, we live in Glendale, but we know you're probably over your head in your mortgage. We know you're probably having job issues. We know that this satellite community is having issues with immigration. We know that these folks are having issues with education of their children. We know that you're having parenting issues. What can we do for you? And maybe the answer would have been a place. Maybe the answer would have been a collection of books. But maybe it would have been radically different. But it still would have been a library. Why? Because there's a commitment to service. There's an understanding about how we organize information. There's a facilitation. Right? Because along with this changing nature of libraries is the changing nature of librarians. Increasingly, librarians are unshackled from the collections. It used to be that when you would ask a question of a librarian, their answer, their world of solutions was behind them in the stacks. That is gone. That is gone for many reasons. One, they have an internet access, so they can answer you from anything. Delightful. But the other thing is, we've seen a massive shift of ownership model to a rental model of collections. Your libraries that we have for so long seen as owning a collection these days is an economic agent that is renting it more and more and more. We're seeing that the ascending resource of a library is the librarian, unlike the peaking collections. And I think I spelled that wrong, so I'm sorry. What do I mean by that? Several libraries have seen circulation statistics go up and up and up and up, and they're starting to go like this. Now, what's amazing is the up and up and up. You guys are an up and up and up world? Now, what's amazing, of course, is that you've been an up and up and up world since probably the mid-80s, right? We like to talk that the economic tsunami has brought a massive increase to libraries, and it has, but it was part of a growing trend. We forgot to tell that story, right? But the other one is, how are your electronic resources doing? Right? So we can see a plateau where our circulating things that we own is doing this, and the stuff we're renting is doing this. This changes the nature of the job of a library and a librarian. It changes the nature of a trustee. It changes the nature of a community that's using that. Do you feel good investing in something that you're owning it as an economy of scale? What do we do? What do we want to do? What do we want to continue to do? But the librarian is someone that has become agile, someone who can work across these tools, across these missions, across these collections, across these different tool sets. Once again, they can work womb to tomb, they can work in the state house, they can work everywhere. So the change has happened in the tools, but not the mission. The mission of librarians is still to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in communities. I would argue that this mission has stayed relatively intact for the 3,000-year history of librarianship. But the tools we use are not the same. I mean, let's face it. At some point, when the folks in Alexandria started seeing these radical new wind-up things come in called scrolls, they probably had a committee about what to do about the changing format. Well, the slates are more durable. Clearly, the slates are more durable. Yes, but this is, ready for it, mobile technology. We can take it with us. I mean, you know, they probably had, like, you know, Alexandria Library Association, and what are we going to do about the scrolls, and how do we catalog these things, and anyway. The mission has not changed. The mission is about knowledge. And I want you to know something about knowledge. This is not knowledge. This is a rock. Why do I tell you this? The idea and the phrase recorded knowledge is right there with intelligent rock. It's an oxymoron. You cannot record knowledge. It sits here. The minute you encode it, you write it, you speak it, you record it, it becomes something else. It becomes a document. It becomes an artifact, which is important and useful, but pales in comparison to the original knowledge. Now, I bring this rock up. This rock is actually outside of Taliesin West in Scottsdale, Arizona. And if you look at the rock, it's an interesting rock. As a geologist, I can look at this rock, and I'm not a geologist, but I play one on TV. I can look at this rock. I stayed at a Holiday Inn Select. I can tell you what kind of rock it is, how old the rock is, where it came from. If I'm an archaeologist, I can look at these pictograms and ideograms and tell you about cultural significance, meanings, utility. But when I look at this rock, I think of a great time I had with my wife in Scottsdale. Nowhere in the rock is any of that information. It's a rock. We bring it here. And I don't care if you're talking about a rock, or you're talking about the Gutenberg Bible, or you're talking about Daniel Steele, or you're talking about an ebook, or a web page, or a podcast. I bring the knowledge there. I understand and learn from it, from what I bring to it. Now, so when I talk, it's not knowledge. Rock. Remember the difference. Knowledge comes from conversation. Now, this is where I have to pretend that I'm not going to dissertate at you a moment, but this comes out of something called conversation theory, because it's always important as an academic that I mention the word theory. Of course, they just devoted me full professor, so I don't have to worry about it. I'm retired in place. So anyway, conversation theory came out from a fellow by the name of Gordon Pask, who was a sort of chemically enhanced professor from England. It was delightful. And what he wanted to do, better living through chemistry, didn't say which ones. You gotta love chemists. Chemists are the ones that put up a diagram, and it's a glass, and they have a diagram that says, water, half full. Air, glass, completely full. Right? And just some chemicals. Anyway. Sorry. Yeah. Gordon Pask wanted to teach machines how to think. And what he did is he said, until artificial intelligence catches up, I'll deal with natural intelligence. So he looked at how people learn. And you've got lifelong learning everywhere around here. And what we know is, when he looked at learning, he said, the way people learn is they learn through conversations. Now, the vast majority of those conversations are with ourselves. And if you just sat there and said, what did he just mean by that? Who were you talking to? Right? Now, if you've been in a library and you've seen people talking to themselves, you realize this isn't always the most conducive atmosphere to knowledge. But it's true, right? Have you ever done this? You're walking down the street and you got two places to go on opposite ends of the street. And you say, I'm going to go there first, but you haven't quite convinced yourself, so you do. Right? That's an internal conversation that's gone totally awry. But this conversation that we have with ourselves, with individuals, between groups, when your organization put this grant together, you were having a conversation. That conversation was, what do I want? What do you want? What can we do together? And it got formalized in language and agreements and all this fancy stuff. But it was a conversation. Right? So when you read a book, whether it's an e-book or whether you're reading one in paper or whatever you want, you're not having a conversation with the author. Right? If you really want to know what was in Hamlet's head, Bill Shakespeare's not waiting to tell you. He's gone. Right? You're not talking to the book. It's dead. It's paper. Right? It's why, by the way, I think the idea of adding social networking tools to cataloging is silly. Because the books and catalogs don't have a social life. They like wait for you to leave at night and sit there and go, did you see that patron? Oh my God. You know, and Vanity Fair's walking around going, if they could wash their hands before they open me. Whatever. So we have conversations. So that means that if libraries are in the knowledge business, not the book warehousing business, not the stuff business, but if we're in the knowledge business, we're in the conversation business. These places, these facilities, these things, these librarians are about facilitating, enriching, and enhancing conversation, enhancing knowledge within ourselves as well as the community. How many people have ever asked a question and been absolutely amazed by the answer, right? When you hear this from reference librarians, a great reference librarian said, I became a reference librarian, and the thing I remember most is when someone asked me, do clams sleep? And she goes, I have no idea. So she like started looking in books and resources, and believe it or not, the book on clam sleeping has not been written. Opportunity now. She called like Woods Hole Institute and aquariums, and she asked biologists, do clams sleep? And the biologist said, I have no idea. Yes, apparently no one ever looked. It turns out that clams have moments of dormancy, but I don't know if it's sleeping. Conversations. They go on. We learn. And what does it mean then? What does a librarian do in this? If conversations, by the way, happen, they happen when you're reading fiction. They happen when you're reading nonfiction. They happen when you're talking to your brother. Maybe not so much with your sons. I've got two of them. But I do learn things I don't wish I didn't. What is the role of the librarian there? Facilitation. What does facilitation mean? Well, facilitation, we do it through access. And we spend a lot of time and resources and budget. If you're on a library board, if you're in a library, if you do your own collections, you look at access. You go, that's what we do. That's what libraries do. We provide access. But access is insufficient. Leave a 3-year-old in your math section. Come back a week later. They will not know calculus. Access alone is insufficient. So what else must librarians do? We must provide baseline knowledge. When we talked about getting a job, getting a job is interesting, right? That when you want to apply for a job, regardless what the job is, you've got to do it online. That means we've got to teach them how to get online. Basic computer skills, basic literacy skills. That is the role of a library. That is the role of a community. Not simply say, there are the computers, good luck, right? It says we go beyond that. We also must provide a safe environment to do that. Now, that safe environment may be physical safety. I'm going to go in here and not get beat up. But it's also intellectual safety and social safety. Many of the people seeking jobs are not comfortable seeking jobs. When they walk into our libraries, they have already overcome an amazing block of their own self-confidence. What do we do to support and reward them for doing that? They must feel safe coming in. Right? We provide an intellectually safe environment. And we must understand their motivation. How do we reward people's effort? How do we understand why they're there? How do we support what they're there for? This idea that somehow we're not allowed to know, or don't ask them why they want to know. It's important that we do. If what we do through this grant is provide a place for people to search for jobs, we have failed. if we provide a safe place where people can explore their options and opportunities and find jobs, that's going to be a sign of success. We must understand what motivates them. We must support what motivates them. We must create a community. So we come back to what is a library. Now, this picture will not look radically different. Excuse me. I'm going to drink and hope that that helps. And it's water, so it won't help that much. But this is the Free Library of Philadelphia. This is their music room. Now, what's amazing is you say, oh, it's a library. How can you tell? Look, there's stuff. Now, what's interesting about this picture is I want to show you the exact same picture, relatively the same thing, from the 1920s. Now, it may be hard to see in the back. Notice these things? We call them windows. Notice these things? They're called lights. And what are these strange things here? They're tables. So, when you compare these two pictures, as a psychologist, if I were like sort of a xenopsychologist arriving from Mars, I would probably diagnose the people who control this room with hoarders. Right? This is like the TLC series where they can't throw away things. Right? This idea that a library is filled to the rafters with stuff is actually a relatively new invention. It is a relatively, as in less than 50-year concept, that libraries collect it all, collect more, and put it all together. And in fact, what we're seeing in public libraries and academic libraries is a move away from this to things like the commons view, creating areas of interaction and discussion. Interestingly, we're going back here, except we're letting them talk when they're sitting at the table now. So that's a great advance. So, community members, one of your responsibilities in this is to look at this picture and say, why? Because I don't want to pick on my librarian colleagues, but given time and unlimited budget, we would actually fill up the windows too. Right? Now, the problem is, community members, your job, you have an equal obligation. Your obligation is not to believe that the libraries when you were nine were the best and ultimate example of libraries. Right? So when you look back, I hit board member after board member. It's like, well, why can't we just put more stuff in? And why would you? I was on a library board. They very admirably increased the materials budget of their library 10% every year. Economic recession hits, not this current one, the previous one. And they said, oh, how are we going to continue to increase the materials budget by 10%? I know, wait for it, we'll lay off some librarians. And I said, interesting. Where are you going to put the books? Well, they'll be on the stacks. Who's going to put them there? I don't know. Who's going to catalog them so people can find them? I don't know. Why are we doing this? Well, we've done it for every year. Maybe we need to think why we're doing this. That's the social compact again, having this conversation. Now, sticking for a moment with the Free Library right up the street decided that they were going to put a massive expansion onto their central library. They had to raise about $100 million through public or private financing. They didn't have any more money left on the credit card. And so they had to go and they said, we're going to build this thing, give us money. And what they had to do was come up with a convincing story. Why should we invest in a public institution with our private funds to build this? And when they laid out this plan, the librarians looked and said, well, we'll move these books over here and these books over here, and we'll put compact shelving all over here. Compact shelving is that really cool, fun thing to use that really looks like crap in a library, right? And the people who were trying to do this went nuts. They said, this is crazy. We're not building a twice as big book temple. We want to rethink this. And so what I want to show you is some of the stuff that we came up with thinking about what does a future library look like and how we did it. The first thing is we said we need to get away from the idea that Dewey told us what rooms we need. This is the business room. This is the music room. This is the whatever. And we said if libraries are here to enhance conversations, what conversations do we want to support? They came up with entrepreneurial, small businesses. We want people starting new businesses. Music. We want to support the culture and musical scene. Writing. Writing is we have a very active writing community. And seniors. We want to deal with seniors because of the changing demographics.
And rather than thinking of that's a room, that's a room, that's a room, that's a room, or that's a collection, that's a collection, that's a collection, they began to think of them as places that were branded and co-owned. So we asked the business folks, we said, okay, business folk of Philadelphia, what can the public library do for you? You know what their answer was? Nothing. Thanks. Don't need you. Go away. We're talking to Fortune 500s and Comcast and all these other people, and they said, we don't need the public library. Now, if we'd stopped the conversation there, we could have all walked away, been very depressed, and said, we failed. But we gave it that extra beat. And they all looked and said, but when I started this company, I desperately needed the library. I was working at company X, Y, or Z. I couldn't use their resources or they'd own the ideas. I couldn't use their resources because they didn't have them. So I went to the public library. They had million-dollar databases licensed for me. They had resources. They had a place. Turns out my living room was a crappy startup office. Right? We were talking, for example, to single mothers. Single mothers who wanted to start their business. Their number one concern? Child care. They needed the time to think about this. So when we talked to them about an entrepreneurial space, we said, what does it look like? They said, it doesn't look like that. It looks like this. We need a place with computers. We need a boardroom to pitch. We need access to angel venture capitalists. We need the ability to come someplace, store it, work in groups, bring those groups together. We need to learn what a business plan is. We need field trips to successful startups. So the library was going to offer field trips. Entrepreneurs would come in and they would leave the library and it would still be considered a library service. We talked to the musicians. We said, well, what can we do for you? And the musicians said, great ideas. We want to do matchmaking, team making, and whatever. What can we do for musicians? They said, you know what the space should look like? Two grand pianos on a stage. Because when musicians were trying to perform, they were walking around with scores going, wasn't quite the same. The language they use to express the discussion and conversation they have requires them to play. If the library is going to support their knowledge, support their conversation, they must support their language. They must support the ability to play. The other thing they said is, in central Philadelphia, there's no place to perform. There's just no space, no venues. And for us, the number one value is in performance. We can write all we want, but if we don't get to perform it, it doesn't exist. And they said, by the way, we don't care what happens after the performance. Just the performance is validation for us. They said, record it. They said, put it in your collection, podcast it, distribute it, create a whole Philadelphia sound and put it out there. Put a lecture ahead of time, music appreciation. Create contacts and connections afterwards. But we want to perform. And that's what the public library is about. So we talked to writers. We said, writers, what do you want? They said, oh, that's really easy. We want two spaces. One space needs to be big, wide open, with tons of power strips. Because we're going to bring our laptops in, we're going to write, and it's going to be absolutely quiet. And then the second space we want right next to it needs to look like this. Now, to be honest, they didn't say kitchen. They said salon, but that's just too snobby for me. I also bring this up because it gives me a chance to bring another Joan Fry Williams quote up, which was, we need to stop being the grocery store and become the kitchen. And that goes back to the idea of not simply consuming. Right? When people come into the grocery store, you buy the stuff, you put it in, you walk away. When you come into the kitchen, you cook. You try, you invent, you try stuff new. That's what we needed. So the writers wanted a place that they could converse and talk. With the senior center, what do seniors want? It was not another place to do this. We worked with WHYY to create a broadcasting facility. What they wanted was, we have these memories, we have this history, we have this legacy that isn't being documented anywhere. We want to create oral histories. We want to work with a library of materials to produce new material. They were creating this stuff to put on the web, to broadcast over the public station, and then they were coming together in the library for a place to talk about it, discuss it, come up with a new thing. Production, creation, understanding. You want to capture a generation's memory. You don't ask them about things. You ask them to produce it. You ask them to create that material. Frankly, scrapbooking is an amazing new archival standard. What are we doing to support that? Right? Now, in all of these centers were co-governed. No one said, what we want is the library to figure this out and tell us at the end how it worked out. But what was amazing is they wanted to have an ownership in these centers of the community. But each one of these community groups, each one of these conversations wanted radically different governance. Some wanted basically, the entrepreneurs wanted a board with bylaws and rules. They wanted their face on the wall. They wanted, you know, good stuff. The music center wanted a curator. They said, we in no way want to edit what gets performed. We want someone in the library to edit it for us. So they wanted to find a trusted source who would pick for them. The writers, let the library do it. We don't care. If you got a question, email us. And the seniors, different kind of governance. But each one of them, and this is just as important, had underlying it a curriculum. It wasn't enough simply to put a set of services together and walk away. You needed to have guidance and a path through it. You needed to teach. Truly, the open university model. For example, for entrepreneurship, if you want to start a new business, you have to write a business plan. I can give you a book on a business plan. The problem is you don't probably know that you need a business plan, much less what it is. In the British Library had a business reading room. They wanted to transform it into an entrepreneurial center. You know what they did? They took all their reference librarians and they got them certified financial planning. They took the reference librarians out and they hired a greeter to meet people at the desk as they walked in. And they put together a whole volume and collection around business planning. When you have a conversation that you identify in a community, how do you pass that knowledge along? Once again, access is not enough. How do you teach someone to know about this community, to work in this community, to operate this community? How do you tap into your own community to become that professoriate? How do you tap into your own community resources and efforts to do this? Now, what's amazing about Philly, here's their current building, is that if you show up at 9 o'clock in the morning when they open, there's a huge line to get in. Huge. At 9 o'clock when the doors open, everyone rushes in. Now, the truth of that is, the vast majority of those folks are the homeless from the inner urban core. They go in to use the facilities. They go in to have a warm place. They go in to have some place to stay through the day. In fact, one particular member would come in, walk up these grand staircases, go into the business room where they had an unabridged dictionary, look up a particular word that was not necessarily the most social and used in mixed company, and then begin making sure it was still there, and then discussing the finer points of the definition with the librarian every day. What the Free Library also do is they hosted a author series. They had authors, amazing authors, from Michael Palin to, you know, best award-winning authors to Nobel Prize winners. And, of course, what would happen is on those days, all the trustees would come in, everyone would come in. And a particular trustee was at one, needed to use the facilities, walked out in the middle, walked into the men's room, and was horrified by what he found. And what they did is they said, librarians of Philadelphia, you need to fix the homelessness problem. We can't have this happening in our library. So the librarians sent out a nice question. What do we do about homelessness? They sent it to the city government. They sent it to other librarians. And the information they got back were things like vagrancy laws, how to keep people trespassing laws, policy laws. In essence, here's ways of keeping the homeless out. But the librarians of Philadelphia made a choice. They made a choice that says, wait a minute, there are members too. The reason that we have a public library is to improve the society of which we are a part. And we are not going to segment that by who is able to own a home and who has the resources to do it. We are not going to turn our backs on our own communities. We are going to work to solve the homelessness problem, but the problem isn't what they're doing in our bathrooms. The problem is that they are at our front door. And so what they began doing is they, first of all, hired bathroom attendants from the homeless community. They gave them a job, reward, and resources for caretaking the facilities. They then began to realize that the part of the reason they're congregating is right before here is the park. Social services began to be invited and showing up to the park to deliver food, social services, medicine, all of these kinds of things. And then one of the most amazing and proudest moments I've had looking at Libraryland was when they opened a cafe. Now, opening a cafe in a library is as passe as it gets, right? This is as exciting as having a book in a library. But the way they did it was absolutely astounding. When they opened this cafe, the homepage cafe, the money for the design, re-architecture, and design was given to them by local corporations. The coffee-making material and training of staff was done by Starbucks. The pastries and food, rather than competing with the local community where they had bakeries, is provided by the bakeries of the local community, so they're providing them access. And the staff for the cafe are provided by Project Home, which is a homelessness to work program in the inner core. What the library did is they said, we cannot solve all of homelessness, but we will not treat it as that's the problem. The problem is that it exists, and while we may not be able to solve it, we will try. The best of librarianship to me shows up in these kinds of examples when we see that the essential nature of a library is of the community, where they work directly with their own communities to identify their problems, to identify their expertise, to identify what they can do, and they seek to solve them. They don't sit and deal with how does the cataloging help. Yeah, we've got to worry about cataloging and shelving, but the thing is, what does this community need? Because the time for introspection is done. The time for trivial matters in library land is done. Our discussion on the future of libraries will no longer be found in our discussions of catalogs of the future and our strategic planning. We will no longer look to solve the solutions of the library community by looking to ourselves. Because the problems our communities face are too great, and our potential for improvement is too large to squander it by talking amongst ourselves. Meetings like this, where we have librarian and community member and government and corporations sitting right next to it, this is the future. You're the future of what we're doing. The problems that we're facing our families, struggling to find their way in or stay into a shrinking middle class with the greatest wage disparity in this century. Well, this century is 10 years old, but over a century. We are facing an educational crisis of unimaginable levels. And this is not the traditional, our kids aren't learning, Johnny can't read. This year, for the first time, debt per capita in this country for credit cards was less than debt per capita in this country for academic tuition. To go to college, we are putting people in greater debt than we used to worry about with credit cards. We have a model of higher education, of which I am part of the problem, that is unsustainable. Healthcare costs are growing at a slower percent than tuition. We have an economic crisis going on. We have an educational crisis going on. We have a government that is so polarized that we can't even speak to each other with a toxic atmosphere. We have an unsustainable thirst for energy that is destroying the environment. We have our memory and our cultural heritage and cultural assets are disappearing behind paywalls and obsolete technologies. These are the grand challenges of librarianship. These are the issues that we must wrestle with. Now, I know what you're thinking. The librarians in the crowd are going, that's absolutely right. And tomorrow, my printer's going to be broken. I have a shelving backlog. I have subscription prices that are going through the roof. I'll fix the environment tomorrow.
Right?
I know that's what you're thinking. But if you don't stop and look up, if you don't stop and think about why are we doing this, what is the good that we are doing, what is the power that we have, if you mistake what you do for why you do it, then the profession is lost and the value that we bring to the communities is lost, and the partners that are amongst us today, we become much less of a useful partner. We must solve the grand challenges. And if you can't link fixing the printer and the shelving backlog to a grand challenge, I think you need to do some serious thinking about why you're fixing the printer. I don't think it works the other way around. Now, there's an answer to that. There certainly can be. Access to resources and materials are important. Having people have a comfortable place to work is important. But why are we doing it? We are situated to look into the future, to be an amazing power for the future, to be an amazing partner in this environment. But if we get stuck in the day-to-day, if we get stuck in our own history and forget that our mission transcends any tool, any material, any comment, then we squander the opportunity before us. The heart of our profession, the heart of a library, as developed, designed, owned, believed in, supported by a community. The heart of a library, and I'm including everyone in this room, regardless of where you got your degree or where you work on a daily basis. The heart of our library is service. For too long, as a profession, we have defined service as standing ready to help. No one has ever changed the world standing ready. It is only through action. It is only by seeing a problem and solving it. When someone is drowning, they do not do this and they do not yell, "Help, I'm drowning." They're drowning. They're trying to stay on the surface. They can't breathe. You can't wait for them to ask. These opportunities, these stimulus, having the support of this secretary, having the support of this foundation, having the support of these partners, this is our time. This is the time when people will look back and say, that's when libraries helped solve the world's problems. That is the day when libraries stopped being book museums, when librarians stopped being people of process and started being people of prosperousness. That's the time when libraries transformed themselves from buildings to an agenda, to action, to activism. We are about learning. We are about a better tomorrow. We are about a better future. If we consider ourselves about things and stuff and connections, we have lost. And everyone in this room needs to be responsible for transforming their library, regardless of degree or title. This is the work we have before us. We are the people to do it. You are the people to do it. I don't care what sector you're in, because a sector doesn't solve things. I don't care what name you're giving yourself. A name doesn't solve problems. People do. You do. Your library and your library. You are the library and you are the library and you are the library. You are all responsible for this. You all have the opportunity to change the world today. Don't let the materials and the things and the problems get in your way. Challenge yourself to make that better world. Thank you very much. I think we have 15 minutes for questions.
We have a few minutes for questions. And I think we have roving microphones.
Comments or things thrown also work, whatever you want.
Anyone? Yeah. It's been about 35 years since I was in library school. This makes it seem to me like being in library school is a lot of fun.
Yes, it is. Come back. You know, library schools. Library schools, I hope, are getting more exciting, and I hope we're dealing with more of the challenge. But library schools will only prosper and work as well as the whole community does. And so what we need to make sure is that you also feel part of that library school and part of the ongoing training, because if someone comes to a school and they write a paper about, this is how I'm going to change the world, I, as a professor, can look at that and go, yes, A plus. Then they go get their job and they say, yeah, but we don't have the insurance to cover that, right? Having the nest, we're too frictionless of an environment. We need regular contact with the communities and people out there in the world to say, now, how are we going to work across this problem? How are we going to work on that one? And so my hope is that you'll come back to library school, not necessarily to be an educator, to be a student, but to be an educator, to be a place where you come and on a regular basis engage, saying, now we need to learn this, now we need to know this. What I hope that we produce out of library school is what I hope you folks produce in your libraries. Radical change agents. I believe that if we do our jobs right in libraries and library schools, what have you, because we're all students, it's all about lifelong learning, it's all about continuous knowledge. If we do our jobs right, we prepare agents of radical change that will scare the hell out of us. We will produce people that will come back to us in 6 months and go, you need to do something totally different because I changed it all. And we need to get used to that being a good thing, right? Change is like, everyone thinks it's a great idea. No one wants to go first. But that's what I think the library schools should be doing, but that's what your library should be doing. I mean, what's amazing is libraries, we should talk quietly. All of those of you who aren't librarians, just don't listen to the next part. We fooled them, right? People believe that libraries are stuffy and quiet and conservative. We're about radical change. Think about passionate readers. I love passionate readers. Passionate reading is interesting. Do we want people to read to distract them from thinking? Or do we want them to read so that they challenge everything that they hear? We talk about literacy. Literacy is the ability to navigate and change new things. What we want to do is we want... I hate the read posters. I hate the read posters. I hate the read posters. How can you hate Yoda reading a book and Oprah? I hate the read posters. Because one, you can do it anywhere. Who cares? Right? Two, why do we want them to read? Why do we want people to get passionate readers? Because they put their nose in a book and don't pay attention to the rest of the world? Or because they become much more engaged with the world and much more able to affect change? Right? I think it's the latter. I think when I see passion, it's not, yippee, I'm reading! It's they're reading and it's letting them realize their passion. That's what we need of library students. That's what you need of your library members. That's what you need of your own librarians. I mean, we're a profession. Sedition is a good word for us, right? We read banned books, right? We allow intellectual freedom. We believe in democracy of information. These are radical concepts. Let's embrace that. Sorry. But I digress. Yes.
Yeah, what can you, besides Philadelphia,
yep,
can you tell us about what are some of the national models? Besides Philadelphia, what are some of the national models that really set the pace in strategy?
So besides Philadelphia, a couple of other places to look at, particularly in the public sector. I am a huge Sari Feldman, I think stalker would be the right word. Sari Feldman is the director of the Cuyahoga County Public Library, which is outside of Cleveland. Cuyahoga County is actually one of the places that the whole housing bubble began bursting earlier than most places. She had a situation where she had, and I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but the scale is right. She had something like 20 or 30 branches. And when economic crunch hit, she had to close Sunday hours for about two-thirds of them. She was at a conference where she realized that when you go to get your passport and you go into the post office and you give them the $50, you can do that in other places besides the post office. And the post office and wherever you do keeps a percentage of that. And so what she did is at all the open branches on Sunday, she did passport processing. She made enough money in 6 months of that to open all the other branches. Now, my point of that is that's entrepreneurial. Right? And it's not crazy. It's still service-oriented. It still fits within it. So I look at services like that. I look at what I see in Ann Arbor District Library. Ann Arbor District Library has a whole staff of what they call production librarians. Production librarians aren't to produce things for the library. They're to produce things for the members of the library. So when someone comes in and says, I got this crazy idea for a website, a video, a project, a production librarian works with them on a one-on-one basis to produce whatever that crazy idea is. And it becomes part of the collection, and it becomes part of their material. I look at some academic library examples. Both Princeton and Drexel do this. When freshmen come in, they're assigned a personal librarian. So when they come in as a student, their personal librarian sets an appointment to go, all right, what classes are you taking? What kind of materials do you know? Here's something, these kinds of things you should be aware of. Well, a concierge librarian within our public spheres where we say, look, what's your project, what you're working on? This idea that we play this privacy game. We don't know you, Dave, right? We don't know you, Fred. We don't know, right? That we don't know, we do know our members. We do know our constituents. We need to do it on a regular basis. I look at embedded librarians. In many situations, you look at librarians that are working directly with chambers of commerce and small businesses on working on new plans and productions, and they meet with them on a regular basis outside of the library. Radical concept. I look at the bookmobile in many libraries has been replaced with the cybermobile, where instead of driving the books around, they drive a broadband accessible wireless lab to different communities where people work at. So I see lots of these examples bubbling up. And I think for too long we've looked at them as anomalies, and we need to look at them more like the canary in the mine going, how do we split that? That's innovation. That's librarianship. So Meg Bacchus, the other quick story, I mentioned her. She's the Civil War. She also wanted to have a square dancing session, and there wasn't enough room in the library to do square dancing. So there was an ice rink, I kid you not, a quarter mile down the road. So she did it at the ice rink, not on the ice. The next day she came into her library and all the librarians were like, what was that? Square dancing. It was a library program. They said, no, it wasn't. It wasn't in the library. Now, Meg is smart enough to just sort of skip right over that. This is a woman who loans out her dog. She has barcoded her dog. She calls it bark coding. I love that. So when the kids of the local community go, I want a puppy, I want a puppy, I want a puppy, she goes, all right, here's a dog. See if you still want it an hour, right? When their library, the reason they're a quarter mile away from an ice rink is that they're also on 30 undeveloped acres because the people who own the acreage, like, are in jail. You know, it's one of those things. But the owner said, if you can get a backhoe in, I'll carve paths all through that area for hiking trails and for cross-country skiing. That she then can enter, and she has a community gardening with lots. She enters those as items in the catalog, so when people look up physical fitness or gardening, it comes up as turn around and get started. Okay? Now, I can keep going with a list and list and list of examples. What all of those say to me is, I'm engaged with the community, I'm trying to solve their problems, it's not about the stuff, it's about the problems I'm solving, and to hell with any of the rules and tradition, I'm doing what ultimately solves that issue. Now, Dr. Norman is going to point out that at some point we have to evaluate and assess to make sure that's working so that we can then take that data and share it and disseminate it widely, which I hope is one of the efforts here. Right? Could you imagine video conferencing with crazy people going, how'd you do that? How'd you do that? I think that's fantastic. Sorry. Come on, one more.
That is, change doesn't come easy.
Mm-hmm.
And in the public sector, it's even harder.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, what's the secret?
I was just talking about a story of Bob Martin, who was director of IMLS, and he was the state librarian of Texas, was sitting across from the legislature at some point having a discussion with the legislator, and the legislator would say, well, why don't you do this in the state library? And Bob Martin would say, well, it's not in the law. The law says we can't do that, to which the legislator responded, son, we make laws here, right? I think the idea that we treat the government, the public sector, the this as separate than us, as opposed to it's a collection of conversations and people that we can have conversations and engage with. I think that's the first step, is to know who those folks are. And I don't mean know as in read it on a web page. I mean know who those folks are. The best advocates for libraries are not librarians. The best advocates for libraries are the people who ultimately benefit from it. I think that we need to change our reward system. The secret of success is failure. The secret of success is failing epically. That you never achieve something that you didn't think you could achieve unless you reached a little bit too far. And so we need to create a culture where we reward experimentation and change. And that's going to happen at the director level, absolutely. And it's going to happen at the peer level. So I think that the idea that the public sector, the slowest, most bureaucratic organization I ever worked with, and I had contracts from the Federal Department of Education, but the oh my God. But the worst one was AT&T. It was the most bureaucratic organization I'd ever seen. Right? It's not what sector you come through, it's the attitudes of the people running the thing. If you have people who are conservative and don't want to change and are rule-bound, they're conservative and rule-bound whether they're going for a profit or going for a vote. So I don't think that's the division. I think it's knowing people, engaging them, and showing direct benefit. And that's the trick, is you must be out and amongst them. Another quick story, and I have no idea if I'm getting to your question, but you get back to it. A law librarian at the Department of Justice was in her office typing away. Lawyer pops in and says, I got to be in court in 30 minutes, and I have to have this information. I've been searching all night, and I can't find it. To which the librarian took the information, did a quick search, and handed them a printout in like a minute flat, right? Because the librarian knows how to search LexisNexis. The lawyer doesn't. Now, rather than saying, oh, those lawyers don't get it, and rather than saying, oh, that's an opportunity I'm going to leave by, the very next week that law librarian began offering, and I kid you not, a course called Character Assassination 101. Because the number one thing that she knew from talking with her lawyers, number one problem they had is they were bringing up expert witnesses, either their own or other people, and they had to discredit them. So Dave Blankus had to go up and tell, and it was against you. What you need to know is everything that Dave Blankus ever wrote or said that contradicted what he was about to say. Dr. Blankus, I see here in 1938 you said the internet was a useless experiment. Now you're telling me it's really cool. What's wrong with you? Right? One of those things. And so what the librarian did is they got up and they said, all right, this is how you search for this information, or we can do it for you. This is how you search for information, or we can do it for you. This is how we search for information, or we can do it for you. So it was a matter of knowing that community, being amongst that community, figuring out what their priorities and working for it. That doesn't happen if you don't leave your building. It doesn't happen if you clearly define things X, Y, Z, and you're not allowed to vary. It doesn't happen unless you say, you know, you just spent a month on that project and it went nowhere. But what did you learn? Right? That's the kind of culture we need to set up. And once again, this is something where these partnerships are really helpful. Human resource, so partners, community partners, any of you in human resources deal with troubled employees? You know, a couple of you?
Yeah.
Right, anyone in library or there? Right. The idea of sharing and getting to know, public-private partnerships. I was in many a public sector where they said, the government says you can't do that. So you know what I did? I found a really good patron who wanted to do it, and I ghost wrote their blog for them. Right? I created a contract, and they became my SWAT team because we could run it through a contract, and so they had an arm's-length relationship from us. Those kinds of work in the systems is what librarians should be good at. We're used to doing that in our search systems. We need to use that in our political systems as well. So I'm rambling now, terribly. But for every example I have of a librarian telling me I couldn't do it because of this legislative environment, I can give you another one who said, we did it anyway, and turns out okay. Right? It's the personality, it's the people. That's why I keep coming. It's not the stuff. It's you guys. And once again, librarians, non-librarians, community partners, people who live in a community, you guys are the ones that make this work. All right. Done? Okay.